Hello, and welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. Today we get to hear from David R. Gillam, the New York Times bestselling author of City of Women, as well as a number of other books like Annalise, a novel of Anne Frank, Shadows of Berlin, and the Audible original Alone with the Stars, a story of Amelia Earhart. He worked on the business side of the writing world before becoming an author and now lives here in Western Mass. Thank you so much for being here today, David. What's happening in your writing life right now?
Well, right at the moment, I'm in at the end of a first draft of a new novel, work in progress. I'm returning to Berlin in 1941 rather than 1943 when I was in City of Women. And the working title of this book is City of Night. It's based very loosely on a true story about a serial killer who was terrorizing Berlin, murdered 10 women during the blackout in 1941.
Wow, it's really making a blank spot in my mind so apparent to me that I haven't read or heard a lot of stories of Berlin during the war. What inspires you to write about that time and place?
Well, I sort of fell in love with Berlin when I was doing research for a book many, 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 many years ago that I wanted a decadent setting for. And so I knew, well, Berlin during the 20s, you know, the roaring 20s during the Weimar Republic before the Nazis, was known culturally for its quote-unquote decadence. And so I said, well, that sounds like a perfect backdrop to this book, and started doing research. And the book faded into history, but my desire to learn more and more about Berlin did not. And I continued to, you know, I've been there, I've seen this. You know, I go to Berlin now and search for the Berlin that's sort of not there any longer. The hints and traces of Berlin in the 20s or the 30s or even the 40s. And I feel very comfortable in the place. I can sort of step into that location, that setting, without much trouble when I'm writing.
Amazing. I'm so curious as well, what inspires you specifically to focus on women in your pieces?
Well, you know, that's a funny story in a way. I was working on another book years ago again, one that was never published, but it had, I had a male main character. He was married, and halfway through the book, I realized the book was not about him. It was about his wife, not about Schroeder, but about Lily. And so I started again and went through it, and that just worked so seamlessly for me that I've just written about women ever since, really.
It's really nice to find a perspective or a character when you can really just write from that voice.
Yeah.
And in that novel you wrote about Anne Frank, she survives the Holocaust?
Yes. I mean, I read her diary late in some ways. I was in my early 20s already. And it just hit me like a thunderbolt. I mean, it just laid me out. Her talent, her intellect, her maturity for such a young person, and her instinct for writing. It was just amazing. And so for years, I tried to come up with some angle to write about her. And I started writing when I was 28, and I just didn't have the horses for it yet. And I put it away, and then I tried it again years later, and it still didn't work. And then it hit me, the idea of the most famous quote that Anna is known for is probably, "I still believe that people are good at heart." Well, one of the reasons I started writing this book was because I was really curious to think, well, if she had survived Auschwitz-Birkenau, what would her opinion still be? That was one of the reasons. And another reason was, you know, in my own kind of humble way, I wanted to try to give her the life she didn't have. So she came back to Amsterdam and her father was there. And...
Wow. So beautiful. Thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. What I'm about to read to you this afternoon is a slightly abridged excerpt from a novel in progress. So nobody's ever heard this before except my wife and my agent. Its working title is City of Night. And though it's fiction, it's loosely based on a true story, the hunt for a serial killer who murdered 10 women in Berlin in 1941 during the blackout by throwing them from the trains. My protagonist is Ursa Jäger, a woman in her 30s, whose father was once the chief of the Berlin murder squad, but who has now lost his position because he was booted out by the Nazis, and he's now also sinking into dementia. But she manages to insert herself into the investigation of hunting down this serial killer. Now, the scene begins with Ursa as she enters the S-Bahn train platform, alone and in the pitch dark. As a child, she tried to be a good little sleuth. She had the mind for it, so she'd learned to armor herself with her steely abilities and put them to good use. She was, after all, her father's daughter, trained to evaluate the unseen significance of every circumstance, the value and consequence of every action. A certain dispassionate machinery of mind was expected of her. Emotions? They were untrustworthy, a deadfall for criminals and victims alike. And yet, there's always been that fugitive yearning in her. She has an instinct for desire, some ancient haunt of longing bequeathed to her by her dead mother. That's how her father puts it, her mother's daughter, after all, with a craving for the unattainable. She is climbing the steps of the empty train platform at the Rummelsburg S-Bahn stop. Contrary to earlier claims by the authorities, the city has proven vulnerable to British bombing raids. Darkness, therefore, is now official policy. Light is contraband. After sundown, it is prohibited by law, and Berliners must adapt, just as they have adapted to the insanely complex point system of the rationing regime, just as they have adapted to the cigarettes that taste of sawdust and the coffee that's ground from acorns, to powdered eggs for breakfast and extended work hours, to shortages on skim milk instead of cream, just as they have adapted to reading between the lines of every newspaper article, to informants on the buses, on the trains, in the queue at the greengrocer, or across the hall in your neighbor's flat. Just as they have adapted to the return of young soldiers from the East, minus limbs, and the trainloads of coffins that arrive at the Berlin rail stations after midnight. Yes, Berliners adjust. The blackout, huddling behind blackout curtains at home, stumbling through the streets at night, what can be done about it? The blackout hours last from sunset to first light. They have been enshrined by regulation. The 8th Ordinance of the Implementation of the Air Protection Act has inked out the streets from the boulevards to the back alleys, shrouding the town from the bombardiers of enemy aircraft. Which is more dangerous, ducking a Royal Air Force bombing run or crossing the Potsdamer Platz after dark? That's the joke without a punchline. Who can deny that the Brits are up to no good in the darkened skies? Sacrifices must be made for the good of all, correct? That's the party's line. Sacrifices must be made for the sake of the Volksgemeinschaft, the vaunted people's community. In any case, she must admit that bombs aren't choosy about who they fall on. So she's willing to do her part, especially since she has no other choice. And yet, there was something so oppressive to Ursa as she utters the blackness she has entered. She can live without butter, but must she also live without enough light to see her hand in front of her face? The enforced darkness is enveloping as she hears the solitary echo of her heels on the concrete. The S-Bahn, Berliner's commuter rail. S for schnell, quick, fast, hurry, as in, can a train please hurry into this godforsaken station? Midway, she stops dead, trying to sense how close she is to the edge. One misstep and she plunges down onto the tracks. Simple. It's happened all over the city. Even the propaganda ministry, normally so meticulous in its suppression of bad news, has permitted the papers to publicize blackout incidents as a warning to careless Berliners. But the danger of the edge is not what has triggered this tang of dread she is suddenly tasting. She has taught herself that fear is too expensive a luxury for a woman alone. She reminds herself that this blinding darkness is nothing but dead space. And yet, it lurks. Against all logic, the darkness lurks, as if it has achieved a kind of skulking animal consciousness, as if it has acquired a certain avarice intelligence which has been aroused by her intrusion into its dominion. The darkness, she feels, has taken an interest in her. Footsteps on the concrete. She snaps her head around at the sound. Someone is approaching, but she cannot see a thing, not a goddamn thing. Her heartbeat deepens, and she is embraced by a clammy sweat. The footfalls grow closer, a measured pace, yet closer. Her muscles tense. She can make a run for the stairs, but the Rummelsburg platform is built atop a rail viaduct and canopied by a steel roof, so any exit requires loudly clambering down a flight of stairs into a lonely arcade where she could be easily intercepted. Also, running blindly could be the mistake that deposits her onto the track bed. Better to make a stand, she thinks, if she must. If she must. Her handbag contains a fabric shears, because sometimes a woman might require such an item, and not just to snip a loose thread. Carefully, she unsnaps her bag. The footfalls stop. She realizes that she is staring fixedly into the darkness, as if she can simply will herself to see through it. Her hand slips into the bag and her fingertips touch the steel of the shears. But then, from down the tracks, a familiar racket approaches, the hairy two-note clacking of an S-Bahn train chasing its schedule and the laborious squeal of its brakes as it decelerates. The distance between herself and the footsteps hardens. The train blunders in, its windows blotted by blackout curtains. It squeals to a halt. S-Bahn carriage doors close automatically, but must be opened manually. Further down, a passenger exits through a third-class car. A bluish crease of light slices across the platform, and Ursa thrusts her being at that wedge of light. She is of delicate build, so she's staggered when she collides with a dark stationary body a meter away. She hears a husky grunt, but does not pause, not for an instant. Bursting into the carriage, she rolls the door closed behind her with a thunk. The train lurches forward and she lurches with it, barely able to catch herself before tumbling into someone's lap. And there she sticks as the car travels into the unlit night. Rooting her feet in place, she breathes deeply to steady her heart. The other passengers of the car, however, are utterly disinterested in her arrival. They are oblivious to her sweaty little fears and her panicked escape. The crowd sits on hard wooden benches of a third-class carriage, a heavy mass of indifference, a scattering of men, workers from the nearby marshalling yards, and a soldier or two, but mostly it's women. Just as in the rest of Berlin, women, 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 heading home from the extended shifts at the metal press factory of the Schulzkais Kraftwerke, their kerchiefs wrapped in turbans on their heads. Women heading home from the films. Women are better diplomats playing at the Universum. Fighter Squadron Lutzow at the Ufau Palace. Home from a cup of ersatz coffee and tasteless cake at the cafes, or home from duty in their Wehrmacht auxiliary uniforms. There's very little talk, just a general slump of exhaustion and a haze of fatigue has hung over the city since the reappearance of the British bombers in September. The trains barrel into the next station, and she joins the masses exiting the carriages into the busy exchange. Ostkreuz, East Cross, is a Turmbahnhof, a twin-level tower station that serves as a major transit hub for Berlin East. Concrete platforms and wrought iron lampposts. The place smells of axle grease and sausage stands. Ursa marches up the steps to the upper level, minding her own business like everyone else. Even at this late hour, the Ostkreuz is bustling with Berliners trying to make their transfers in the sickly wartime light. But the jostling crowds actually help appease her anxieties, so that by the time she boards the Nordbahn, she can begin convincing herself that her panic on the dark Rummelsburg platform was nothing but foolish nerves. She boards the Nordbahn and actually finds a seat. The carriage lights blink on and off. Maybe it's the unwashed stink of the passengers, but her head is thickening. Or perhaps it's simply the profound exhaustion that has seeped into her bones. Sometimes she feels like she can sleep for days, longer, a lifetime. But when she allows her eyes to drift closed as the train carries her along, she finds that she has returned to the darkness of the rail platform, replaying the sound of those footsteps. They were heavy steps, intentional, measured. Perhaps a man wearing boots. Could it have been a soldier? There have been problems. Soldiers out for a night of drinking, a woman alone after dark. She's heard the stories at work. Stories whispered when the men are not around. Part of the black market of gossip in Berlin. Stories that never appear in the newspapers or earn mention on the wireless. Stories that have prompted her to start carrying the sewing shears in her bag. The train slows, and more passengers stand as the carriages labor into the station. So she joins them. The door rolls open, so she is carried away by the crowd into the harried, orderly disorder of the Bahnhof Ostkreuz. A booming loudspeaker voice announces track changes, delays, and dispenses official instructions. Yet the noise and the jostling crowds actually serve to appease Ursa's anxieties. Passing through the station, she's thinking about what she should eat when she gets home. There may be some of the potato soup remaining, and perhaps a slice of black bread spread with chemical goop that now passes for butter. But then, as she exits the station doors, the true depth of the night confronts her once more, and her pulse of fear returns. The blackout. It's only a few minutes' walk to the apartment block in the Jablonskistrasse, where she lives with her father. Not far. Yet progressing through the darkness seems interminable. Directives laid down by the Reich's Air Protection Bund forbid even the tiniest sliver of light which could aid the navigation of the RAF bomber crews. Not a porch light, not a bicycle lamp, not a single lit cigarette are permitted. Police officers are authorized to shoot out offending lamps with their pistols, and passerbys are encouraged to toss a stone or brick through an offending window poorly masked by a blackout curtain. Curbstones are whitewashed with phosphorus paint as a small concession to pedestrian life, as is the limited use of pocket torches with their lenses masked by a piece of red tissue. Ursa carries one such torch in her coat, but the battery is drained, and in any case, she feels too pursued to bother with it. Sprinting across the street, she aims for her apartment block. In the daylight, her building is a mustard brick Wilhelmine brute called the Ostpromenade. But cloaked at night, it's nothing but a looming black hulk. Reaching the door, she turns the key in the lock frantically and hurries into the foyer, securing the door behind her, breathing quickly, shutting her eyes as she presses her spine against the door's solid barrier. She curses herself for acting like such a frightened mouse, but tonight she can't help it. Somehow, she is still listening for the sound of those footsteps on the S-Bahn platform, as if she expects them to have followed her home. A door creaks, and Ursa's eyes pop at the light inside the concierge flat. Fräulein Jäger, the Frau Meier calls out, her bulk wrapped in a wool robe. It's your lieber Papa, the woman answers. He's off his crazy head again. Her father has always been devoted to precision, meticulous in his appearance, orderly in thoughts, always well-groomed, not a hair out of place, never a button missing. Shoes always shine, rational in thought and immaculate in deed. So it's painful, so very painful to find him like this, slumped in his long underwear at the concierge's kitchen table, frowning vacantly. His feet are bare and dirty, his eyes raw, his thick snowy hair tangled. Frau Meyer's boozer of a husband sits across the table in a nightshirt and a stained pair of trousers, braces hanging down. He assesses Ursa like a vulture.
So, Schatzen, the old rooster tried to fly the coop tonight in nothing but his flannels, he informs her, chewing on the stump of a pipe. Good thing your old Uncle Meyer was here to clip his wings.
Her father turns toward her, his face ashen, his eyes narrow, unseeing. Does he recognize her? Hard to know. Mostly he simply looks bewildered. Bewildered, frightened, shamed. Shepherding up the stairs to their flat, she offers encouragement. You're fine now, Peter, you're fine. There's nothing to worry about. You were just confused, just a little muddled. He does not respond, but follows her meekly, taking each step at a time, smelling in need of a bath. I'm sorry, she whispers, that I left you alone tonight. But now I'm here and you're safe.
But is he?
The concierge, Frau Meyer, has followed them out into the hallway.
Fräulein Jäger,
she calls out. Her voice arrests Ursa's progress up the stairs, forcing her to turn back to the stout figure of the house coat and hairpins.
Shall I worry?
The concierge asks bluntly. Ursa tightens her jaw. Meyer's a canny old specimen with a wolf's instinct for detecting weakness. Technically, her husband is the block porter and responsible to the party, but old Uncle Meyer neglects to spend most of his time drinking down in the cellar. Everyone knows who's really in charge.
No, Frau Meyer, you needn't worry, Ursa answered. It's the air raids, up and down so many nights. His sleep is so disrupted, she explains. Sometimes he's not himself.
The concierge only snorts. Not himself, she repeats with dull disdain.
Is that what I should tell the authorities the next time your papa goes sour in the head and causes a ruckus? That the great man is not himself?
Ursa is silent. She hears her father grunt dimly as she tightens her grip on his arm.
Be warned, Fräulein Jäger, the concierge informs her. I took the pair of you into my building out of charity, she claims, out of respect for your father's former standing, but I will not be made the fool. Is that clear, Fräulein? Am I making myself clear?
Ursa swallows. Yes, Frau Meyer, she answers. For what else can she do? Yes, very clear. Turning away, she manages to guide her father the rest of the distance up the stairs and into their flat, where she plops him down in the old Viennese wingback by the wireless.
Music, Peter? She inquires, hopefully. Music?
She repeats, but doesn't wait for a response. She snaps on the dial of their so-called people's receiver, a cheap tool of the propaganda ministry to give the party a mouthpiece in even the most humble homes.
Radios everywhere, the advertisement trumpets, a piece of subsidized junk.
But at 76 Reichsmarks, it's the radio they can afford. Static makes way for the Marika Roka, warbling wholesomely through A Night in May. Kneeling, Ursa rests her palms on the back of his large hands. His fingernails are ragged. He has started chewing them recently, a new development. Gazing into his stony face, she whispers gently, Peter? Nothing. Peter, are you in there? Still nothing. In the beginning, it was just lapses of memory. They would make a plan for this or that, and Peter would forget, leaving Ursa to stand alone on a street corner, frowning at her watch, or sitting in a cafe nursing a cup of tasteless coffee served by an irritated waiter. Aggravating behavior, but also perplexing. Her father had always been a man whose world revolved around punctuality,
around critical analysis. But then one Sunday afternoon, as Ursa was scrubbing the oven, her father asked her, "Ursa, did you drop off my shoes to have the heels replaced?" Coughing with her head inside, Ursa answered him curtly, "Yes, Peter, as I told you, they are ready next week." She was irritated. Maybe it was the chemical stench of the soap powder, or maybe it was the paternally imperious tone that her father often adopted with her. It made her bones itch. And then, not 5 minutes later, while Ursa was rinsing out the cleaning rags in the sink, the question came again. "Ursa, did you drop off my shoes to have the heels replaced?" And this time, she snapped. "Yes, yes, Peter, I dropped off your shoes to have the heels replaced. As I have said, I don't know how many times I have dropped off your shoes." Of course, it was not so very unusual for her father to pester her again and again over details. He had been rather infamous for making his subordinates crazy in the same manner during his career with the police. But this time, when she turned about, prepared for a squabble, she was surprised by the look of shock on her pater's face. Those huge blue eyes blinking, confused and wounded by his daughter's outburst. "Well, you needn't bite my head off, daughter," he replied. "It was just a question." Later, after the cleaning rags were rinsed and hung to dry over the edge of the sink, Ursa had felt guilty over her response and intended to apologize. But when she found her pater installed in the old Viennese wingback with his wireless tuned Haydn symphony, she hesitated. He was wearing an oddly sunken expression that she did not recognize. "Pater?" "Yes, Bartchen?" Bartchen, little bear, a name he'd called Ursa since the beginning of time. "What is it?" "Nothing," the little bear decided to say. "Nothing. Just wondered if you would like another cup of coffee." At this, her pater had blankly examined the gilded porcelain cup on its saucer, placed on the side table. "No, I think not, daughter, thank you." Ursa swallowed. "Of course, Peter. Oh, one thing, though, that I meant to ask," her father had added. "Did you drop off my shoes to have the heels replaced?" A beat. "Did you hear me, child? I asked if you dropped off my shoes at the cobbler's." "Yes," Ursa nodded. "Yes, Peter. I dropped them off. He assured me," she began to say, but was forced to start again. "He assured me that they would be ready next week." But even as the words left her lips, a strange feeling of dread was opening up in the pit of her belly, a feeling that has only enlarged itself since then. She cannot help but remember the lesson of Frau Winkler, one of their neighbors above stairs. Poor Frau Winkler, as she is now cryptically referred to by the building's inhabitants. She was found wandering the street once too often. Then came the letter to her son, Gottfried, a letter committing her to a well-known mental house north of the city. A month later, his mother was returned to him, but in a cremation jar. Heart seizure, the attending certificate informed him. Afterward, Ursa could often hear the son playing his mournful violin above them, graceful and dripping with grief, even though, as a profession, he was a bank teller. It's nearly midnight now. Ursa washes the dirt from her father's calloused feet and steers him into bed. He doesn't resist, but as she bends to kiss his cheek goodnight, he grips her arm just as tightly as she had gripped his climbing the stairs. "What is happening to me, Bartchen? I don't understand. Tell me," he pleads. What is happening to me?" Ursa breathes. There are many things she could say, she supposes, so many ways she could choose to answer. A lie, the truth. The truth, though, is too large a mouthful for her to speak. It might choke her. "Nothing is happening, Peter," is what the little bear chooses to tell him. "You're tired. You need rest. That's all." He gazes back at her, his eyes heavy as moons, then loosens his grip. When he was in his professional prime, he had a reputation for detecting the lies told by the guilty. So she wonders, has her lie disappointed him, or is he grateful for it? There is a day bed in the front room where she sleeps. Lying there under the blankets, she stares upward at the crack in the ceiling above her. She can't see the crack in the darkness, yet she knows it's there, a crack like a scribble of lightning in the plaster. They had had a close call last April. A stray bomb had struck an old-fashioned apartment block down the street. Sheltered in their cellar, the explosion had felt as if the earth had shifted on its axis. The next morning, the old-fashioned apartment block was little more than a smoking crater, obliterated from roof to cellar. It was afterwards that she first noticed that the ceiling crack had emerged above her head. A small doodle by the finger of God, left behind as a warning. There is no safety. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. To explore more books, free poems, event information, recordings of our readings, and more, visit galleryofreaders.org. And if you can, while you're visiting us online, share a little abundance because we are a nonprofit and exist through this community. We would love so much to see you at a reading, hear about a book you're enjoying right now, and build our writerly community. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.